Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Stephen Pimper, host of the Public Policy Channel, and we are joined today by Austin Choi Fitzpatrick and Ernesto Verdeja, who are the editors, along with Douglas Irvin Erickson, of Wicked Problems, The Ethics of Action for Peace, Rights, and Justice, new from Oxford University Press. Austin and Ernesto, welcome. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks so much for having us.
So I wonder if we can start off by having each of you say a little bit about who you are and how it is the two of you and your partner in crime came to this particular project. Austin, why don't we start with you?
Yeah, thanks so much for having us. It's really, really exciting to be back here at the New Books Network. I love what you all do. I know Doug wishes he was here because he was one of these, he's an important part of this origin story. It was a conversation we were having at one of the many conferences we as academics go to about sort of abstract and theoretical issues. And we came away from a panel asking ourselves, you know, the fact is that a lot of these struggles for peace, rights, and justice have ethical dilemmas that are the result of action and not theorizing. And so that's this book kind of came out of a conversation, back in the day, the three of us, but particularly from Doug. So if Doug were here, he would have told you that. But what I'll say for myself is that, you know, somebody like most folks in the field, and when we'll start unpacking what the field means, I think, in a little bit, but somebody interested in making change in the world, I came, came from human rights, did some work in humanitarian affairs, and humanitarian aid and intervention, and then moved on into social movements, sort of theorizing and praxis. And across all of those, I've just had this enduring question about how do we know what the right thing is to do? How do we do it? And then what happens next? And that's, you know, really easy on paper. It's really easy in the classroom. Sometimes as educators, we make it seem a little easier than it actually is. But in fact, all of us know that taking, you know, sort of taking action leads to contingencies, it leads to unintended consequences. And I'm presaging some of what we're going to be talking about, I think. But that experience in my own life of taking action, being part of social movements, collective action struggles, etc., is what led me to the dilemmas that then sparked my interest. So when Doug said, we should really do something about this, you know, I said, yes, I love it. Let's do it for sure.
And Ernesto, how did you get mixed up with this crowd?
Yeah, I think, well, part of the problem is that I actually know both of them. So we go back pretty far, especially with Austin, but I've known Doug for a number of years, and both just terrific scholars, but also really thoughtful and inquisitive people who are committed to practical justice and peacebuilding work as well. And so my interest in this really comes from a slightly different background from Austin's. Austin has a lot of experience doing social movements work, both in the United States and around the world on a variety of different justice topics. I've focused mostly on questions of genocide and mass atrocity. So I've always been really interested in thinking about not only the causes of these types of phenomena, but also how to prevent them. And having spent some time also working in the broader human rights atrocity prevention space, you really start realizing that the people who are most sophisticated and the deepest thinkers are often just bouncing from one type of response to another. I mean, they really are just in a reactive mode. And these are really sophisticated thinkers. We're talking about either in the US government or in foreign governments or the UN or in human rights organizations. And I was really curious about how do they think of not only what is the just or right thing to do, but how do you trade off different types of possible policies and answers and responses off the cuff, on the fly, in real time when mass atrocities are happening. So my interest kind of comes from that background. But in speaking to Doug and to Austin, we realize that these types of really profound ethical dilemmas, or what we're calling wicked problems, and that's the title of the book, of course, they come up in all sorts of different peace-building environments. So my interest really comes out of that, and then trying to expand and think a little bit more holistically, more collectively about these types of challenges.
So you both, I think, hinted at this, but let me ask the direct question. Who's the book for? Who's the intended audience here?
Yeah, it's a superb question. You know, I feel like this, over time, this has, I want to say, blossomed or evolved, because we were really starting from where we, you know, as we just introduced ourselves, from where we were planted. You know, me coming from social movements for human rights, Ernesto coming from mass atrocity, Doug with a, with similar sort of background that, that leaps between those. And I feel like as we were working on the contributors, especially, we realized that a lot of the questions we were asking at the sort of international level also played into challenges experienced by folks doing collective action organizing in the United States. Some of it seemed like there's a bit of a historical angle to it. Then it turns out that these are actually enduring and contemporary problems that we'll probably have into the future. And then just as one sort of international or social issue was seemingly laid to rest, another one sparked anew. So we're sort of writing this, you know, like trying to, you know, build the plane while flying in a lot of ways. And it led to not how we started, but where we really have ended up now, as the book is about to, you know, is about to hit the market, with a sense that it's for anyone interested in explaining and better understanding how to make social change in the midst of the space that they're trying to change. Now, what I just didn't say was it's for activists or it's for progressives or it's for, it really is, the dilemma here is if we see the change, you know, if we're going to be the change we seek in this world, and we see that opportunity, and then we look into the sort of individual skill sets we have, the organizations we're part of, or the larger milieu we're in, and then we take action, this really helps us ask bigger questions about what's next and sort of the complexities that come out of that. So this is a sort of I hope it's not a trite answer, but it's the true one, which is that this is for folks who see themselves taking those steps into social change for the first time, or standing and reflecting on, you know, sort of the action they're in the midst of or have just taken. And I think that's a left or a right thing. It really is a sort of an academic thing, but it's also a practitioner thing. And maybe Ernesto, you can talk about the range of folks we've got in the book, because I'm speaking as sort of a, you know, scholar, maybe a little bit of an academic, and maybe a little bit of an activist, I don't know. But we really started playing with some of those identities and roles when we were inviting contributors. So there's, you know, all of these contributors in the book. I don't, Ernesto, you want to maybe say something about that?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, let me add just kind of a few points to this, and then I'll maybe say a little bit about how the book is structured and the types of folks whom we invited to join us. But I think one thing that is particularly interesting and frankly kind of neat about this book is that we decided to avoid writing just another academic book that focuses on one particular issue in a narrow and deep way. So say, what are the ethics of using military force in humanitarian interventions? There's a ton of book on those. On those topics. Or for instance, investigating what are the nature of moral actions in the most abstract way of thinking from kind of a philosophical background for the purposes of thinking about how to advance justice. There's a whole sophisticated scholarly literature on that. But a lot of those types of topics are either a little bit divorced from empirical reality. So they're kind of disconnected, and kind of thinking through how to connect that to real practical challenges is left a little underthought, underbaked. Or there are a lot of books that, again, focus on these narrow but deep types of topics in a kind of very focused way, in a very stylized way, but they don't really give us much of an insight or set of reflections more broadly on the nature of ethical dilemmas in peacebuilding work. So we really wanted to do something a little bit different. Many of the contributions, in fact, all the contributions are relatively short. They're easily readable. They're pithy. They're punchy. They deal with real concrete challenges, but they also generalize out of that to think about the nature of these really profound ethical dilemmas or wicked problems. And just to give you a sense of what that means, the book is constructed broadly along kind of three main areas. And we have scholars, practitioners, and full-time practitioners who've contributed across all these three areas. The first part of the book focuses on the question of violence, one of the most vexing and longstanding questions in peacebuilding. when, if ever, is it appropriate to use violence in order to respond to some kind of injustice or some kind of harm? And we have a number of contributors there that deal with this question. It's really, I think, quite frankly, really provocative. We have, for instance, one contributor who starts off, Tony Gaskew, African-American, former police officer, now a scholar and academic himself, who talks about how the ethical dilemma in the use of violence is not whether violence should be used for the purpose of advancing social justice, but the ethical dilemma is for white Americans to deal with the fact that Black Americans have a fundamental right to use violence to defend themselves and protect themselves against state repression. So the book starts off with a big bang, and I think it's a really interesting and provocative piece. We also have some other contributions in there from Liz Theo Harris and Noam Sandweiss-Beck and Kirsa Klein-Reichman and Ashley Bohr, who also explore these issues of how to balance questions of the use of violence or nonviolence in these types of scenarios. So broad range of contexts, but really kind of exploring that question of violence. That's the first part. There are a couple of other parts to the book. The second part is on leadership and organizations. And Austin's going to be able to say a lot more about that because he really was instrumental in bringing together some of those contributors. But it really looks at the ways in which leaders in social movements, activism, try to navigate difficult questions of, you know, should you be more reformist? Should you be more radical? How do you make alliances with certain groups? What are the trade-offs in all of this? So there's a whole cluster of contributions there. And then just really quickly, lastly, there's another section where we focus on questions of what we refer to as systems and institutions. So we're looking at more organized actors like states or international organizations. And that involves everything from atrocity prevention to the use of sanctions to thinking about how to deal with states in the context of negotiating peace and justice efforts. But Austin, you can probably say something about the kinds of contributors.
I think what you just said is it's for everybody. Is that what you just said? I think that's what you just said.
This book is for everybody. Detecting a theme. This is good for the marketing people, right?
But there
is no one for whom this is not an appropriate text is what I'm getting.
But Steve, it is kind of funny, but you make a really good point. You know, the idea behind the book was we didn't want to just write another book for fellow academics. There's a scholarly apparatus in there and all that stuff is there. And, you know, there are citations, et cetera. But it really is meant to engage a much wider range of readers and people who are dealing with these types of practical issues or want to kind of be able to explore it in a more thoughtful way. Sorry, Austin, go ahead.
So now that I've said that this book is for everybody, let me say that, you know, one group I have in mind in particular who I'm going to hand it to is people who think that change is easy and that the next steps are obvious because the cause is just. I may agree with that, but that doesn't help us together unpack what we should do next. Once, you know, action is engaged, and these are fundamental lessons from, you know, any struggle, you know, violent, nonviolent politics, relationships, these are like familiar struggles. But, often find, and, you know, we're all teaching in schools focused on, you know, peace, rights, and justice, the three of us as editors, and we come in, you know, we have students who come in with a head full of steam, and rightly so. And what I don't want is for that head of steam to sort of dissipate on first contact with the real work and the challenges, the book is trying to invite us into this reflection, not of, oh, here's a stone wall you'll hit, but here is a kind of like complicated equation that requires us to show up with our best selves and not necessarily our best intentions. Well, I don't mean to put those in contrast, but actually it require us to think dynamically in the moment we're in. I'm just echoing Ernesto here, which is what I do most of the time. The fact is that that's not something that's in a textbook. That's more of a way of being. And it's easy then to look back with experience and say, oh, well, that's not how it's done. But that's not how the future gets made. The future gets made by, you know, people with a head full of steam and with moxie and, you know, vim and vigor, a whole bunch of old words for enthusiasm. So this book, I really hope, and now I'm saying, you know, it's for people who want to make change. That's my final answer. Okay, I'm gonna mute myself. No, that's my final answer.
So, I mean, jumping off from there, I spend a lot of time teaching and speaking to audiences of social work students and social work practitioners, almost exclusively in the domestic U.S. context. But that resonated with me so much as I was working my way through the book, is that it really is sort of the attention to the urgency and importance of these issues and sustaining energy and passion without being naive about the obstacles and the challenges, and recognizing that if you are not thinking strategically, not just about the organizational challenges, but the real live ethical dilemmas to which there are not easy, obvious, simple, well, of course, the moral thing to do is X, right? These are in many instances, lots of case studies of situations in which there isn't an easy, obvious answer to say, well, this is what you should do and how you should do it. So let me use that as an opportunity, Warren, to burrow down before we turn to section two, touch just a little bit more on that first section. And Ernesto, you anticipated one of my questions, which was, I love very much that you led off with that Tony Gaskew chapter, because it really does sort of blow the roof off the place right up front. And I think will provoke lots of people. But that section for me becomes this really thoughtful dialogue about how do we, if we recognize, I'll put this in the U.S. context because that's where I know things and I don't really know much about the rest of the world, that we inhabit a moment in which formal institutions of U.S. politics and policymaking are fundamentally broken in many, many ways. And that if we are going to learn lessons from history, among other things, it is mass movement activity that right now is probably the most viable means of disrupting those broken systems and creating space where we've got more democratic politics that results in policies that serve more people. So in thinking about sort of the debate in section one between violent and nonviolent movement activity, and, you know, to speak crudely, first chapter is sort of making the argument for violence, the second chapter making the argument against violence, the third chapter saying, well, there's maybe it's a little bit of both here, right? I was thinking about Black Lives Matter movement, right? So we've got arguably the most widespread and sustained movement activity in all of recorded human history that had at its centerpiece reduction of policing as a means of social control and violence inflicted upon people. And here we are after that movement, largely nonviolent movement activity, increasing police budgets rather than decreasing them. So that's an unbearably long way of saying, how do you, using that section of the book, think through, how do we make sense of that? Should we retain this commitment that a lot of movement activists have for nonviolence as a principle and as a strategic lesson about being most effective? Or is the work that tells us that nonviolence is most effective, largely looking at international context, is it possible that that's wrong and we need to expand our notion of what's moral and acceptable in the U.S.? So with apologies for the length of that question, who wants to dive in?
No, I mean, and you know, the question just, it has so many different parts to it. It's such a rich question. And I think it deals with such a pressing ethical set of challenges that we're all facing right now, you know, particularly in the United States, which is the way you framed it. So first of all, I wouldn't speak for the contributors themselves. I think it's actually worth looking at their contributions, and you can see how they not only make different types of arguments, but they marshal different types of justifications for their arguments, because they're dealing with different dimensions of this big cluster of questions, which is really one of state repression and structural injustice or structural violence. And by that, the latter, I mean just kind of, you know, the systematic marginalization of people economically and socially and politically. I think it's a really hard question because it partly depends on how one dives down and frames the specific question. In other words, if one is focusing on police brutality and police repression in the United States, which is, of course, a defining feature of contemporary American politics, then one focuses on that kind of that sharp end of state policy, right? It's the really sharp, pointy part. And what do we do about that? But if you take a step back, so that would be, for instance, Tony Gaskew, who makes this really, again, this really provocative and I think fascinating argument coming out of the Black radical tradition for saying that Black African Americans, Black Americans have the right to use force to defend themselves against the police. It's a constitutional right. It's part of the heritage of what it means to be American, and it's the right of that particular community. A different way of framing the question, though, is to say, look, there are deep structural questions and deep structural injustices at play here. And we see that in the piece by Liz Theo Harris and Noam Sandweiss-Back, where they talk about the focus on ending poverty. And for them, it's really an issue of poverty and systematic harm and injustice that needs to be addressed. These other types of violence are symptomatic of that. And they make an argument that if you don't include a wide swath of people in a kind of a sustained social movement effort, you're not going to have any change. It's both a normative or moral argument, but it's also a practical argument. I mean, they do make the point basically that alternative approaches, which rely primarily on violence, don't really work very well. What's neat about both of these chapters, and I'm just picking these two, and I'm going to hand it over to Austin because he'll have more to say about this. But what's neat about both of these chapters is they don't only make a philosophical or moral argument, but they think through the logic of it. And they also give us ways of trying to contend with these challenges, right? They really try to canvas all the possible responses and make a compelling argument for why one should pursue one approach over the other. Austin probably has more to say about this. And I would just add that connected to the social movement question, Austin, maybe you can touch on this. There are all also issues of leadership. Who gets to speak? There's issues of representation. There's issues of alliances. How reformist or how radical should you be, et cetera. But Austin, you might want to add something.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So in Austin, as you do that, if you would sort of pick up on Ernesto's lead and finish up that conversation, then lead us into the talking about what we should be paying attention to in section two.
Yeah, we're like reading each other's minds. That's perfect, because I feel like this question invites, and I'm just repeating what Ernesto said, invites reflection at a couple of different levels. And in the second section really invites us into the perspective of leaders as they wrestle with the mantle they've been given or chosen, or if it's a horizontally organized sort of, or, you know, a space, you know, the mantle that's somehow shared collectively across the, this is a really complicated set of puzzles when it comes to who's going to lead and what are they going to lead and for what, and, you know, sort of how and for which ends. And Ernesto just pointed out the complexity, the multiplicity of ends and the complexity of ends. And I think that just to zoom all the way back to that, your question, Stephen, you know, the first thing I'm thinking of is like, well, what everybody's rowing towards is a fundamentally different understanding of what it means in this country, let's say, to be American. It means it's something that looks much more like inclusive care because one is here, not predicated on class, race, gender, other identities, or citizenship, which is ultimately the human rights train has tended to stop at the second to last station, which is, of course, citizenship, rather than going all the way onward toward something that looks more like, fundamentally protected, rights and opportunities. So that's of course where my mind went, was like, you know, it's gonna take a revolution is where my mind went. But back to section two. So leadership and organizations was the section we put together when we started realizing that a lot of these dilemmas were not necessarily just tactical and strategic, this exchange we just had about violence, but were also about identity and representation in the form of what kinds of people are leading what kinds of organizations and whether or not leader is the right verb there. So just for example, I was so happy that she was able to do this for us. Min Dang, who's a colleague at the University of Nottingham, pulled together this piece called The Paradox of Survivor Leadership, where she wrestles with what does it mean for survivors of exploitation to run a survivor network in solidarity with other survivors in the teeth of public opinion about their survivor status. And not just public opinion, but movement colleagues who should be coming along with us in the struggle, who misidentify what it means to be an ally. And then, you know, the next chapter of that is Dan Myers, who wrestles with the question of allyship itself. So if we're actually, you know, aligning ourselves in collective action struggles for, you know, let's say, underrepresented communities, who can be in positions of leadership? Is it only folks who actually come from within the movement and are actually have that collective identity that's part of the struggle and the struggle's demands? Or can we represent as proxies for others? And that's a sort of, now we're not talking about grand strategy here, and we're not, you know, we're actually talking about, was that about tactics or was that about identity? Or are those two things somehow, you know, intersecting in really sort of complicated and sophisticated ways? And I'll just mention one more, you know, sort of chapter here, which is Alicia Sanchez-Gill, who runs a fund for community organizing and grassroots organizing in the wake of Black Lives Matter. She went and curated for us all of these voices from grassroots organizers that are about sort of horizontal leadership strategies, intersectional identities, organizing when success, sometimes short-term success can look like medium-term to long-term. Did we do the right thing? Sort of questions about whether or not that success led to the outcome that the movement desired. And getting that takes us all the way from these kind of like abstract and sophisticated but abstract ideas about tactics, all the way to the point, to the view of folks who are operationalizing them in the midst of their own lives and asking, is this working? And am I the right person? And what happens next? And so I really like the way that the book, and in some ways this conversation, goes from these big, big, big questions all the way to the point where somebody's got to do it. And then feel a certain way about it, talk a certain way about it, tell stories about it so that it can turn into something new or something different. Did that work? Do we need to tweak it? And all of that happens in real people's lives in real time. And I'm so grateful that the activists and organizers who contributed here were able to do it in such a way that we can really, I feel like, step in their shoes, but like, you know, pull us alongside them and try to explain to us some of what that looks like to them.
And you know, one of the things that I particularly appreciated about the work in that section is the making evident all of that stuff that often when you're in the midst of an organization and you're trying to do whatever the organization does, you may be confronting these very kinds of dilemmas, but depending on where you are, they may be all happening sort of at this subterranean level, right? That you're not really conscious of them, you're not thinking about them, you're not thinking through. I think for people who are doing that kind of work and who may be sort of feeling as if they are positioned in weird ways, right? You know, rich white people running organizations that serve low-income communities of color, right? Or, you know, the Dan Myers chapter, right? Sort of a straight white guy leading an organization for LGBTQ populations, right? What does that mean, right? What does that look like? How do you negotiate that? I think that there is so much there that, and this is some of my own background, that having the opportunity to actively think through those organizational challenges in a way that you sometimes don't have the opportunity to do in the day-to-day because you're too busy keeping the lights on, I think is again, going back to that sort of, there's the academic, the abstract framework for those who want that the sort of the 30,000 foot philosophical question piece. But then there's also the, what the heck does this mean on the ground? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah,
just really
briefly. I mean, this is these are the chapters that I've had the most fun assigning to my students and saying, okay, now you saw the conundrum. What's the solution? And it turns out you've got to workshop it. You can't off the cuff it, right? And I really love how that the complexity that invites, you know, sort of readers into.
Yeah, no, that's a very good. Yeah, go ahead, Stephen.
No, I was going to go ahead, Ernesto, and then we'll tip on to section three in our last few minutes.
Sure. Yeah, just as a final point on this, and this is kind of round off what Austin was saying, one of the really things that were neat things about these contributions is that we were able to bring people who are in fact leaders in a number of different LGBTQ efforts and women's rights efforts. And they're basically leaders in these types of social movement organizations. So they can speak to us quite a bit about this issue of navigating identity, but also how to make alliances, thinking about the use of resources, and how to work collectively with others. So it's in that sense, the contributors cover a wide range of people with a wide range of experiences, which is kind of neat. But I can also say a little bit about part three, because I think part three really shifts, it shifts gears quite a bit for the book. And in that respect, it's an attempt at trying to give us some sense of kind of a wide focus or a wide inclusive lens or approach to this question of wicked problems. So, you know, whereas the first two sections, the first one's about violence and the second section has a bunch of articles dealing with systems, institutions, or I'm sorry, with leadership and organizations. It's this third system, this third section that deals with systems and institutions. And what we mean by that is looking at the way more formalized actors deal with these types of ethical dilemmas and also how to actually contend with them. So we have chapters, for instance, that deal with the law, thinking of the law as an institution. Under what conditions does one resort to the law in order to advance human rights? And other conditions do you respond kind of critically and push up against the law? And we start off with a really neat chapter by Dina Hurwitz, who deals with these dilemmas in action as a lawyer herself, as a human rights attorney. So this isn't just an abstract question, but she's someone who works in Israel and Palestine, the occupied territories. So how do you negotiate these things? We have chapters from, for instance, from George Lopez and Beatrix Gagan-Briner, who deal with the issue of sanctions. Governments love to pass sanctions against opponents, against enemies. But what are the responsibilities when you pass those sanctions? What obligations do the sanctions enforcers have to actually help that society rebuild, provided it's actually met its concerns? We know a lot about the impact of sanctions, but we don't talk a lot about the consequences of sanctions post-conflict or post-authoritarianism, let's say. We have a couple of other chapters that also deal with these big actors, whether states or international organizations. One of my colleagues here at Notre Dame, another colleague of mine, Lori Nathan, deals with the question of effectively, how do you negotiate with armed actors to bring about the end of armed conflict? So think of rebels and guerrillas and the state. To what extent do you give them what they want so they'll stop fighting and killing people, knowing that that can also include having to give them some degree of impunity? So it's the challenges over impunity, right? These challenges over mediation. And Lori, like a lot of our contributors, is someone who is not only has a scholarly background, but he's a serious practitioner. I mean, he's been working in South Sudan and many parts of Africa. He's worked in parts of Asia. So he has a lot of experience dealing with these types of questions. And then we also have some interesting work on transitional justice and a final set of chapter or a final chapter that we have that deals with the hard, tricky question that doesn't get enough attention, which is how do you teach students who want to go into peace building and human rights work to contend with these questions? And Austin's already talked about it. This isn't a blueprint. You don't just, you know, read a set of guidelines, but how do you actually think about being exposed to these types of questions and having to do the hard work of reflective practice, as they sometimes call it? Austin, you probably have more to say about this though.
You know, I guess part of just hearing you say this, Ernesto, and hearing these, you know, we've done this sort of like flyover of these three sections. And it got me thinking about the fact that the through line that runs through these, and this comes all the way back to Stephen, your question at the beginning, like sort of how do you guys, you know, who are you and how did this get started? That's that old Studs Terkel question, you know? And it's like, and what got us started is the sense that things that are that sit in different sections of the library are right next to each other in our own lives. And the fact is that we may give money to a grassroots campaign that we really care about at the same time as we see on the news that there are sub-state actors, beefing with the state in armed conflict and nobody knows what to do next. At the same time as, and we live these lives and the people and activists live their lives, we all live our lives in the middle of a couple of different Venn circles, well, lots of them actually, but we've got three of them here. And so these aren't like these kind of I don't know, now for something completely different, record scratch between the sections. But for our own home fields of social movements, human rights, transnational and international justice, we're trying to, and peace building, we all sort of have that lens as well. We're trying to ask what cuts across all of these things. And the fact is that if you take these kind of fields or these perspectives or scholarly traditions on their own, in isolation, one is more internationally focused, one is more domestically focused, one is more sort of attuned to institutions and norms, and those more focused on social movements. But what we tried to do in this book is to say these things are all overlapping in struggles for peace, rights, and justice. And you can't have, we could have done this three different books. This is the systems and institutions book. Well, this is the social movements book. And then we wouldn't get read by one another. We would end up in these little silos, these like narrow citescapes, citationscapes or something. But what I love about this is there's a little bit of an unlikely bedfellows component to the way that we're pulling. We were just talking about Black Lives Matter 10 minutes ago, and now we're talking about sanctions. And we're trying to argue that doing the right thing is tough across all of those different types of action, whether it's international or national, it's sub-state, it's individual actors, it's NGOs and IGOs, it's other states. And so that's the real invitation here, is to see the action we're embedded in as rhizomic or the middle of a Venn or interconnected, whatever sort of metaphor we want for that.
Yeah.
This is the New Books Network, and you have been listening to Austin Choi Fitzpatrick and Ernesto Verdeja talk about their new book, co-edited with Douglas Irvin Erickson, called Wicked Problems, The Ethics of Action for Peace, Rights, and Justice from Oxford University Press, and cannot recommend it highly enough. And I hope that you've all gotten a good sense of the multitudes that are contained within those pages and it piques your interest. Ernesto, Austin, thank you both so much for joining us today. Much appreciated.
Thank you.
This was great. Thank you so much.